This is Dave Saunders.
And this is Courtney Engel.
And you're listening to Market Flow.
Find us on the web at yourmarketflow.com.
All right. Happy Monday. Here we are in the third episode. Hey, we're look at that. We're building momentum. Isn't that exciting?
It's fantastic.
All right. Olympic disappointments, wins you were watching this weekend?
Yeah, hockey. Wow, that was an amazing game. Actually, following along in Twitter, USA versus Canada second time around was very exciting to me. You know, I could do without most of the other winter Olympic sports, but that, and I was just amazed to see how many people that I knew that really don't care much at all about hockey were in Twitter talking up a storm about the game as it was happening, and just, it actually crashed Twitter briefly during the momentum of it all, but it was a fun game. Brought it into overtime, and Canada played well. Crosby got the final goal for Canada, and some of my Canadian friends are thrilled to share with me that they won.
But I was amazed at how much, like, the Europeans and especially the Aussies really seemed to be into the whole hockey scene. I was actually getting a bunch of Skype messages from some friends in Australia. And then, of course, I've got a friend who now lives up here a few miles away from me after living in Sydney most of her life. And she's just a hockey freak. And I found a lot of Aussies were, too. I just thought it was kind of funny. And one person explained it was because of their hard heads. So it makes them naturally resilient to impacts of the ice. I don't know if that's really true. And that was the excuse I got. So I don't know. It sounded like fun, but I got to say, or at least admit that other than about 5 minutes of curling, I didn't actually watch anything. And it's not because I'm disinterested in the Olympics. It's just because I haven't turned on a TV in about 2 months. So that's just how it is. But it sounded like it was a fun thing other than the NBC stuff we talked about last week. And other than that, I guess it was fun. And it's over now, right? I mean, it's actually done.
It is. So 2012 London and 2014, I think it's pronounced Sochi, Russia, Sochi.
Cool.
And that one, that's going to be a heated, there's already a lot of debate. NHL may not permit their hockey players to be involved in that one. It depends upon what the NHL union essentially says, what the NHL players decide that they want to do as well. But there's a lot of debate going on.
What? Why? The Cold War is still cold? What the heck? What's up there?
No. The debate is more raging. The NHL stops play in their winter season for 2.5 weeks. And that's right before the kickoff of playoff season for them. So going into a 2.5 week break right before you enter into playoffs so that, you know, a third of the league can go back to their sending countries and participate in their Olympic teams, that sort of interrupts the season. However, a lot of people are really into hockey right now. And because they're following this, the NHL is getting a lot of that momentum carrying over from the Olympics back in. You know, games for the NHL are back on today. And guys that were playing yesterday in the Olympic game are playing today for their own actual teams in the NHL. So there's just a debate between the NHL getting the effective marketing out of allowing for this to happen and the players' union enjoying this experience. But then the trade-off is this is a real big interference for their entire season. And unless we're playing the winter games in the southern parts of South Africa or Australia in the middle of our summer, it's going to consistently conflict with the NHL season.
Yeah. You know, I think you summed it up in the very beginning, though, which is that they're enjoying the momentum of the Olympics dovetailing back into the rest of the season or the playoffs or whatever. And their solution is to potentially not enjoy that same momentum in future Olympics. See, you know, this is just amazing to me. It's, it's the whole let's kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Whatever. I recognize that, you know, baseball and women's basketball and all of these things are raging and thriving businesses, sports like this, you know, giant stadiums and all that, I'm not under any illusions. You know, it is a business. It is a staged entertainment match. That is the purpose of having the Washington Nationals play and lose so heinously. Almost every game they play is really just to fill the seats and make money. And I'm okay with that. In fact, I went to many Washington National games this past year and watched them really embarrass themselves in the field. I hope they do better this year. I really do. But I do recognize that it's about going out and, you know, all jokes aside, it is about, you know, drinking beer in the sunlight and eating nachos and hot dogs that have been steaming since the beginning of the season. It's all good. But at the same time, I'm fascinated when you even get to the point where, like, there's these controversies about whether or not we're going to take advantage of people's interest in our sport by choking off the thing that was giving us interest. So I'll be interested in hearing how this turns out, and maybe we'll be talking about it in 4 years. Who knows? What episode would that be? Let's do the math. Whatever. Anyway, so let's move on and let's talk about we've got the quakes and tsunami and all kinds of stuff going on there, and some pretty, I think, amazing stuff going on with social media to help respond to that, not only in what's going on there with Chile, but some stuff that I was just recently informed of and learned about in terms of how the Haiti response works. So why don't you talk about what's going on with the quakes?
Well, good news is my sister is alive. She is without internet and phone, but she does live in Santiago. And so
shaken, but not stirred.
Very shaken. Yeah. It's been a trying time in the last couple of days here. In the process of finding out about the news, you know, within 2 hours, I had heard from her. But in those 2 hours, that was just absolute anxiety to the roof. I knew she was out the night before. She and I chat frequently across pretty much any instant messenger client. We have each other as friends on every imaginable IM platform. And sometimes we'll switch it over to Skype audio calls. And she and I had spoken the evening before, and she was heading out for the evening and told me her whereabouts and where she was going and what she was doing. And that was the last I'd really heard from her until around 9:30 our time. And I had gotten the news around 7:30 Eastern time, which for her is 2 hours earlier. So for her, she felt the quake, and she was out at a club at the time, felt the quake, and, you know, the crowd just dispersed from the floor that they were on, and she ended up staying with a friend that lives on a first floor because she lives on the 17th floor of her apartment building in Santiago, and just trying to track her down, you know, I had friends involved in the Haiti situation. Very good friends that were living in Haiti. And then this brings it around to now it's my sister. And now we've got a quake that's even more dangerous in some ways than what had happened in Haiti. And, you know, instantly I was digging through our Facebook information. I was doing a very poor job. I do not know Spanish. I took Latin in school, so I can make a feeble attempt at this. But you know, I was making an attempt to get my information translated into Spanish and instantly contacting her Chileno friends that I'm not even friends with, but I could see were tagged in her photos there, saying, have you heard from her? Do you have any news? And eventually it got to the point where, you know, obviously I'd sent out a couple emails, didn't get any response, but she popped up in Skype and we were able to just chat for a little while to hear the story of what was going on. And since then, she's kept us updated as much as she can. She's without electric, and at times it's kind of intermittent. Mostly it's on. There are a couple of major fissures in the building, and her internet's pretty much out. The cell phone network, because towers were downed, it's a little overwhelmed, so trying to dial her via phone line is still dicey at best. And so she tries to make it to an internet connection a couple times a day, just to let everyone know, yeah, I'm okay, because they're experiencing, at last count, she had over 90 aftershocks that were registering as greater than 5.0. And, you know, with all of that happening, this was a real sense of oh my gosh, what's happening with my sister? What is going on? And I was, you know, monitoring what was happening in Twitter and watching the news and doing everything I could all at once to just try and locate anybody that I knew in that area. And came across a relieving story, you know, finding out from my sister. But then I also saw just the crowd in Twitter is really, they're really good at getting this information out, at locating things, at helping each other, you know, through talking to my neighbor who's got a nephew that's there, through talking to another friend of mine that lives in the Lancaster area, you know, trying to help them track down their family members because I knew somebody that had a phone that was working in the area. Just amazing ways of seeing how technology is helping us account for people and track each other down and how powerful it is. And I've seen some other really great applications being developed as well, you know, with Google announcing there's an area that there are applications that other people can develop and Google can develop and commit to maintaining. But Google has an area called AppSpot, and in that they've launched a couple of easy applications, and one of them is to help track down missing people in Chile, whether it's someone that you're hunting for or you are somebody that has information on others. And, you know, CC Chapman posted this information right in the midst of all the news breaking, and it was just really relieving in a sense to see how the social media is now not just us relying upon first responders to get in there, but we have ways of more effectively communicating with friends, family, loved ones that are there, and just for the good of helping everybody else out, making use of any means that we can to help start just a grassroots effort of finding people, accounting for them. And it's just been a real blessing in the last two instances of major earthquakes, you know, to have personally known people in the situations, a lot more relieving than it would have been, say, 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to just kind of see how this has evolved, too, because during Katrina, there were people who were, like, posting on, like, comment space on CNN's website, you know, because you can comment on stories there. And so people were actually posting missing person data, not only looking for but found information through, you know, the comments fields. And they would do it on any site that they could find where, you know, there was already a discussion going on and they would just leave it with the comments. And then, you know, it's interesting, like the AppSpot and a number of other crowdsourced efforts going on just to really respond to that in amazing ways. There was a crisis camp in Washington, D.C., where people just started showing up and they were, you know, throwing in development efforts. There's actually a Ning site for this, crisiscampdc.ning.com, and also crisiscommons.org. One of the guys really very active in this is Noel Dickov. And, you know, it's pretty amazing how they were just able to pull together and take some basic map data and then construct a back alley detailed map, even with house data. And then we're then you know, basically threw it over the fence so that Red Cross workers were able to load it onto their handheld GPS devices. And they actually had house level data that they could use to go from house to house to do some searches there. And then this is actually a little bit more experimental, but it's just fascinating to think where this could go. One of the big efforts that you go through, and by the way, there's a bunch of videos on my YouTube channel, which is NEMOCK, N-E-M-O-C-K, from the DC Media Makers meeting last week, where there was actually a presentation done on this, and they actually showed a bunch of slides of specific things that were done. And so I videoed the whole thing. We streamed it live. But what's really interesting is as the house-to-house searches are going on, there's a code that's written on the door of each of the houses to, you know, tell that it's been searched, how many people were found, how many body remains might have been found, things like that. And one of the challenges there, of course, is that you need to make sure that you've got people who can write down the data, you know, legibly. And of course, it's, you know, it's a complicated effort. And some people were actually then going to the roof and they were adding some of the same information that was put on the door. They were then going and putting it up on the roof. And this got one of the people thinking. And what they did was they created a one of these two-dimensional barcodes, which is, it just looks like, you know, old, you know, little graph paper pictures, you know, from elementary school math class or whatever. And what he did was he created a really basic encoding system, and that you know, encoded the same information, you know, house has been searched, here's what we found inside, all that basic info, and put it on a sheet of paper. Now, of course, this does require some technology, but it would be really interesting to see, like, Red Cross workers actually have, like, you know, portable printers, and this kind of stuff is available, and basically slap it on the wall and slap it on the roof. And then what he did was, just using a slide of this two-dimensional barcode shot from a poor angle, he took a picture with his iPhone, and the iPhone app then decoded all of the information. Now, this next step further where you could take this is you could just position a visual satellite over the disaster area, and the satellite could actually then do the recognition of those 2D barcodes from the roof and actually do a cataloging of all of the house searches. So, you know, there are still some infrastructure issues there, obviously, on the ground. You know, you got to get the cell phone towers back up and things like that. And Noel actually talked about some of the challenges going on in Haiti, just dealing with getting the infrastructure back up so they could even then use texting as a means of communication, which he said was awesome. I mean, sometimes keeping a long time voice circuit going was really problematic, but texting is, you know, able to deal with bursty sort of traffic. And so that was really, I think, amazing. And it's incredible how, like, all these different social media pieces can not only be used to, you know, help out right there on the ground, but then more importantly, to pull together volunteer efforts of some just amazingly creative and talented programmers to really create some technology, sometimes within a day, that, I mean, my gosh, if you went to then one of these larger organizations, and all due respect to the Red Cross and all of the, you know, government responders that, you know, help out here. But, I mean, the same thing that Andy did in the demo that you can see on my YouTube channel, he did that in a couple of days. I can imagine the government, you know, spending 2 or 3 years trying to develop exactly the same technology, just because there's so much more slow moving, because, you know, everybody's got to dot their I's, and then you got to be, some congressman has to make sure that his, you know, state's district is represented in the two-dimensionalness of the whatever. It just gets so bogged down. And so it's awesome that you can go right down to the people and say, we need help doing this. How can we make this better? And some of the ideas that came out of Crisis Camp DC were just incredible. So, pretty amazing. And a lot of that technology, you know, moved from Katrina to Haiti, and now it's moving down to Chile. And so it's pretty interesting to see and follow where that's all going to go.
Interesting. Yeah, I saw on the news this morning that USA Today is calling for the U.S. will be in the quake zone soon, and just yesterday, Japan had one off of Okinawa, and so there's some interesting things happening right now, and I look forward to seeing how crisis camp makers are able to help contribute into getting the information disseminated. It's pretty interesting to watch the news coverage now. They're turning mostly to Twitter, I noticed, with CNN. I was a little disheartened to see they were so excited over the tools that they were using, the information that they're pulling together, because they were watching Twitter in English and Spanish, and they had translators available and all of this. They were so excited about their technology use that inadvertently they really came off with the wrong message. They were thrilled with the technology, but they were reporting the deaths. And so you had these reporters that were elated about all of the information available to them, covering some pretty disheartening information, and it really came off to people like they were just cold and insensitive, and that was a little bit of an interesting backlash to watch. But, you know, So it goes. News happens, and new things move along. So speaking of other news that has happened, I recently came across an article by Robert Scoble and a couple of other articles posted last week regarding Second Life, and I thought this thing was about dead. Second Life, interesting environment. Have you ever installed it, opened it up, taken a look at it, Dave?
No.
No. Okay. So, but you have done other things like World of Warcraft, right?
More than I would like to admit. I will go on record here that I do have a level 75 dark elf druid, and I'm not afraid to use them. But my WoW account has been inactive for a year now, so I'm not even sure if I still have. It's really depressing to think that I build this awesome virtual character. He can fly and he can kick all kinds of butt, and then what? I mean, how much data can it possibly consume? And World of Warcraft deletes my character? I mean, hello?
Sorry, so, you're speaking a foreign language to me at this point.
So Blizzard has more or less, I tried once, and it might have just been a password problem, but Blizzard may have more or less guaranteed that I will never play World of Warcraft again if they actually deleted my character that probably took up, I don't know, what, 64K worth of space at the most on their website? I can't imagine it takes more than that. I mean, come on. I'll buy them a hard drive. Yes, World of Warcraft, and I am aware of Second Life, but no, I've never delved in.
Okay, so it's an interesting place. 2005, I think it was probably coming into its own with getting a lot of buzz and hype. There were bands that put on these concerts especially for it, and Reuters did a lot of news reporting into the space. Essentially, I wouldn't even call it a game. It is similar to a game in that you've got a character in this virtual 3D space and you're walking the thing around and doing activities in it, but it's not necessarily there is a mission or a goal here.
That sounds like life.
Yeah.
Hey, life is a game, so whatever.
Right. So for those that aren't aware of what Second Life's purpose essentially is, it's just another area to get in and connect to people and chat, and you can be all kinds of interesting things that you want to be. You can make whatever you want to make, and you can do whatever you want to do in this place. Some like the anonymity for more interesting activities, we'll say. Others, like the educational community, like it for a classroom environment that takes on a different perspective. They like the 3D aspect of people being in many different locations and being able to all collaborate in on one project, whatever that project happens to be. There are schools that are using the educational version of Second Life. There are a lot of support within the educational and teacher community world. I've seen a lot of people that are not letting go of what Second Life was potentially going to become. They've just been announcing a lot of overhaul usability changes. They haven't made any updates to their core search engine, but I thought it was a blast from the past to start seeing this flood of Second Life information coming in that I haven't seen in, 3, 4 years or 5 even, about what people are doing in this space and how they're making use of it. So I'm curious to see if it's going to kick up again, unlike other more actual games. Now, don't get me wrong. You could go into this space and play a game of chess. You could go and have an object to go travel around somebody's made-up island or something and go find stuff and do whatever. But, in this kind of a space, one of the things the Second Life developers are really proud of is that, everything that they're doing essentially is free, and they've got this incredible economy that's still thriving with an online business model, and people are still making a profit by creating virtual goods and selling them in this 3D virtual space. And it's just kind of fascinating to see that there's still maybe some Second Life to Second Life. It was interesting to come across that information this week. So we'll see. It's something to monitor a little bit, but not give a whole lot of thought or attention to too long.
So Second Life getting a third life.
Maybe. Yeah. Good.
Time will tell.
Yeah.
What else we got? We got Yelp. They're getting sued. And of course, this is all what we're reading. So, don't sue me. Your mileage may vary. But I guess as I understand it, the accusation is that Yelp marketing and sales reps are being accused of allegedly, I'm going to like stick all these words in here. As the complaint is, the people at Yelp are charging to remove negative reviews from businesses. And so, you know, normally on Yelp, obviously you've got, you know, places can have positive reviews, people can leave bad reviews, which of course can happen anywhere. I mean, Yelp isn't the exclusive place for this to happen. People can do it through Twitter. They can do it through their own web page. And so Yelp just obviously creates a really nifty site that I love, where, you know, people can share stuff. And you know what? I've honestly gone to Yelp to find places. And there have been times when I have actually chosen a place to go to based on the Yelp reviews it's received. There have also been times when I've seen a place that's actually had a few number of stars because of a couple of people who left really, really negative one-star reviews. And I read the reviews. I actually took the time to look at the reviews from the people who left those negative reviews, decided that they were cranks, and went to the place anyway, and then left my own one time 4-star and a couple other times 5-star reviews for the places that these other people had complained very vocally about. So just because, you know, in my opinion, I know not everybody's this way, but, you know, it's the same thing for like, you know, what, you know, Frommer's and Fedora's Guide. I mean, just because they, you know, pan a place doesn't automatically make it bad. It just means that the people who are being paid to put the reviews into a book, info product, they're just, you know, it's their opinion. I've heard Gary Vaynerchuk, I think one time I heard him describe a wine that he tasted on one of his videos as tasting like cigarette ash. And I think he then mentioned that he sold out the wine. And it's just because people wanted to try it. And I guess as I heard this, I don't know if it was from him, maybe in his book or whatever, but I think I heard that there were lots of comments left where some people said they didn't like the wine and other people said, I don't know what you're talking about. I think this wine tastes great. So, you know, I think Yelp provides exactly the same kind of democratization of data as those sorts of things. And you know, there can be negative and positive reviews. But anyway, the point is that some people want to have these negative reviews removed. The allegations are that Yelp is or some people at Yelp have claimed that you have to pay to have the negative reviews moved. And I don't know, that sounds like extortion to me. That's not really a great approach. I would dare say that unless you can actually prove that a person is, you know, doing something, you know, libel or slander, one of those things, blah, blah, blah. Unless somebody's actually, you know, really, you know, being directly abusive or saying something that is, you know, factually and provably untrue, the reviews should stick. I mean, if you've got enough people that like your restaurant, you shouldn't really worry about one or two bad reviews. They happen. Some people just don't like, you know, your place. I went to a place in Georgetown in D.C. a couple of weeks ago, a place I do like. I'm not even going to mention the name. But I went there and I got to say that I had possibly one of the worst restaurant experiences of the past 10 years. No, I'm going to say of this century, the worst restaurant experience of the 21st century is what I had at this place. Now, I've been to this place before and I think it's a great restaurant. But I'll tell you, this one time, it was just abysmal. And I'm not going to go any further than that. But the point is that that could have been my first time. And I would have panned these people on Yelp or, you know, any of these other, what's it called, the Urban Spoon and those other places. That can happen. But even from my personal experience, it was one out of several times I've been there when all my other experiences have been awesome. And that one time, it just really stank. So it happens. So I don't know. It's kind of weird. It's interesting to see how this pans out because I do think it sets a weird precedent that somebody says something in public that you don't like, and so you want to go have it taken down. One, boo-hoo. At some point, I'm sure there's going to be people who say stuff about me that I don't like. It happens. Actually, it's already happened. And you know what? That's fine. They can deal with it. And I can too. Now, if they actually say something that I've got a legal angle on, yeah, I will defend myself. And so if somebody wants to say something that is actually verifiably untrue, I will protect myself legally, and I will punch that person in the trachea, legally speaking. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's kind of weird. So I'm interested to see how the details pan out for this suit. And who knows? Maybe it'll get thrown out. Maybe it will reveal that there are some shady things going on in Yelp. At this point, I don't think we have any idea. So that's where that's at. But, you know, I think it is interesting because, you know, Yelp and these other sites, Urban Spoon and you know, heck, even like Foursquare, where you can, you know, put in little comments as you're checking into a place. You know, if there's even, I think, a hint of precedent that people somehow can't leave negative reviews, I think that sets a really bad precedent. And woe to the business that actually tries to establish that, because I think the backlash at this point of people and the way we're connected, we will tell our government what we have decided that the government will do legislatively to represent we, the people, and the businesses who incorporate at the will of we, the people, because we created the states that then give them their licenses. We will decide how the people do the business with those states that are granted their charters by the states that we created, if that makes sense. So, you know, they can. I think some people can try to manipulate the legal system to tweak this around, just because if their business sucks and they don't like people talking about it, too bad for them. If there really is something shady going on here, then shame on Yelp. But if this is just a case of sour grapes because somebody runs a crappy business and doesn't like to get called out on it, well, then screw them. So that's my two cents on it, and we'll just have to see how it pans out.
Interesting. Very interesting. All right. Next story, case studies. Have you ever been in a situation, Dave, where a client wanted to know, what's all this social media stuff about? Why do I need it? And has anyone gotten any results? Or what's the ROI of social media? And they want lots of details and proof.
Of course. You know, and you get everybody, you know, when you're the one paying the money for the marketing, you're always the one that wants information that doesn't actually exist. You know, you're going to advertise an entrepreneur magazine and you want to actually know the ROI of your full display ad, or you've been running some pink bunny on TV for what, 30 years. And you want to know if it's actually really feeding your brand, or if you've just spent 30 years blowing hundreds of millions of dollars for no apparent reason. It's a rough thing. And social media opens exactly the same can of worms in any situation. You know, I'm surprised that when people ask about social media ROIs, that they don't then say, well, gee, why should I allow my salesperson to go to a Toastmasters meeting or go to the Chamber of Commerce? I want to know the ROI of them doing a PowerPoint presentation for local businesses. You never seem to see people ask those kinds of questions, and yet for social media, they do. That notwithstanding, it is really nice to be able to see models of what businesses are doing successfully with social media. Not necessarily so that you can follow it step one, step two, step three, and expect exactly the same results, but so that you can simply have models of what other people are doing successfully and use that to feed your own creativity, to see how it could fit your business, to see how your business can engage other people through social media and through the real world, by the way. Just because social media is online does not mean those people are not real. So, social media and, quote, real life to me are the same thing because they all involve real people. But Anyway, there's this really cool website called casestudiesonline.com, and it's a crowdsourced collection of social media case studies. And crowdsource, of course, means that people are submitting their own, stories and, industries like advertising and pets and automotive and children's products and clothing, computers and electronics and nonprofit organizations and government organizations and just different associations. And I think it's pretty cool that people are actually sharing their stories. And of course, you know, we can see some of these stories online too. I mean, we can watch Whole Foods, or we could watch Zapato's shoes. We can just see what's all going on out there. And I think it's pretty amazing that there are lots of cool social media case studies out there. And then, of course, it leads to the question of, well, what are you going to do? Do you take these social media examples and then try to apply them entirely internally, or do you then go and actually hire an outside party to run your social media campaigns, but at least with the understanding of what's going on? And to me, I think that's pretty cool that you can see a case study and then, I don't know, demystify the process a little bit, even if you're going to hire out. So what do you think?
Yeah, I came across this after listening to Command N just a little while ago, another podcast that I really love. And they interviewed the guy that created all of this, and it is pretty interesting to see how he's pulling it together. He just launched this not too long ago. He happens to be doing some of the same marketing consulting type of work that I know that you get into. And he's dealing with clients that want facts, figures. They are very analytical. They want their all of their information ahead of time to know what's going to work. And of course, we're playing in such a new sandbox that no one really knows. And you just have to get in and start doing stuff to get any results to begin with. You know, so he's looking for information, and he couldn't find any examples of just true, genuine, here's what we did in our marketing efforts related to the internet, and here's the results that we got. Couldn't find bottom-line information without calling endless amounts of companies and things, and of course, that information wasn't organized based on demographics or location or, industries or any of that. So he decided to start creating his own list of swipe files, essentially, places to go back and look at information to say, I think I saw that article somewhere. Turned it into a website, and now it's free, open to the public, and it is still in the young phase of its entire existence, we'll say. But it's just getting started. They're looking for people to submit any kind of case studies that they have. Just, here's what we did, here's the results that we got, and feel free to contribute into this. You know, people may want to actually contribute any examples they have simply because that's another way to get their brand out there, get their name in yet another spot, which is great. But it's also a way for those that need the facts and figures to go and say, look, what is working that's even remotely close to what we're doing here? Because some people still want those bottom line numbers.
That's kind of cool. Have you actually watched many of the case studies that are up there yet?
I watched one or two of them so far. One was involving selling an airplane. There was a special antique kind of airplane that had a price tag of, I think, $140,000 or something, and they had a budget under which to get this thing sold, and they turned to social media marketing to get it sold and did some YouTube things, did some Facebook fan pages stuff, and some Twitter info, and the plane was sold.
That's pretty cool.
Met the goal. Yeah, it was kind of interesting. Just kind of dug around inside of that a little bit. And so, it was kind of neat to look at that. And then you start looking into things like, how did they build the community? Was this just broadcast marketing, or were they building connections and relationships? So that was just, it was fascinating for me to look at how this all came together. Yeah.
That is kind of interesting. They're nice examples to see for folks that, do kind of approach marketing very analytically and unfortunately, usually unsuccessfully. Because they spend too much time over analyzing the relationships that they're not getting. It's cool when you can kind of see that because it gives you something to model. And, so I don't know, did you happen to count how many of the, case studies are up there as of now, or
I don't know that. No, but I know they're daily adding to it and daily sending out emails regarding what's. You can get on the email list if you want, or subscribe via RSS readers or whatever method you want to follow them. And they're adding information pretty much daily. And of course, as this thing starts getting more and more attention, I expect more information to get submitted to there.
So. Yeah, I would definitely say it's worth, anybody that's, trying to engage folks through social media, just go here and just start clicking on just some of the videos. And, again, it's not about trying to turn any of these things into a recipe, which incidentally, recipes rarely come out exactly the same way every time because there's kind of a nuance to cooking as well. And so I think it's pretty cool that you can at least just see and sit back and watch, here's the steps we did, and use it as a model for, how could I do this with my business? How could I be creative in such a way that I can stand out and, make a connection and build a community with people and then ultimately sell my stuff? Because, hey, I'm okay with that. I'm not one of these anti-capitalists, so. I'm all good with, building a community so I can sell my stuff, or, charitywater.org, build a community so I can raise money to dig a bunch of wells. That's awesome. All those things, whatever your version of sell my stuff happens to be, that's pretty cool.
Speaking of sell my stuff, that's a really good segue. You have more?
No, I thought you were going to pitch me.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. Dave, get ready for this. The segue is you need to go give or sell more. Awesome book. Fantastic book. That's my book pick of the week. Go Give or Sell More by Bob Berg. Are you familiar with the Go Giver book one in the series?
And we're not being paid to review this book either, right?
No, we are not getting paid. Definitely not.
So not an affiliate book or anything like that. So we're just sharing the book that we like. So this isn't really a sales pitch.
No,
necessarily.
But
you're sharing.
If you do actually want to go get the book, I'll give you a link that will benefit my Amazon account, though.
Yeah,
disclaimer.
I'll make 10 cents. I can go to the movies by myself.
No, not yet. So... Go Give or Sell More. Go Give or Sell More came out. I got it through Audible, actually. I like the audiobook of this. I like hearing Bob and John read to me. Bob Berg and John David Mann did a great job with this book. It takes the premise of The Go Giver, which, if you haven't read that, I would say start with that and then move on to Go Give or Sell More. It takes the premise of the first book and really turns that into a little bit more... hands-on what this looks like in your daily work area. So every business is concerned with how do they make more money? How do they, by making more money, that's the bottom dollar type of information everyone knows. But in doing so, they're concerned with helping more people. In order to help more people, money's going to have to factor into this. In order to exist, money factors into this. So at the end, we always are thinking from our business needs to sell more stuff or help more people, and that creates more money, and on the cycle goes. So in the first book, they laid out five basic principles in a story format. It was a quick read. I think I read the book first in that case, got through it in, I think it was one plane ride across the coast to coast. And then the next time I dug through it was an audiobook format, and that was 2.5 hours as an audiobook. And, really quick to the point, but in a story format, and it really lays out what are the five laws of stratospheric success, as Bob puts it. And so in this breakdown, what you have happening is really taking a look at five elements that go into making what people say are sales and making an income, but how to do this in an authentic and genuine way. So there's lots of sales formulas out there. If you're in the sales-related industry, there's what to say and the magic formula to say it, feel, felt, found, and running through the form model. If you're familiar with sales, you'll get the reference. But there's lots of equations that get people to move from finding out about your product to buying the product.
And you can Ben Franklin them too.
That's a new one. That's a new one. So, right. Explain that one to me later.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
don't do it.
Book is really good at just saying your first goal is really just to get to know people. And Bob Berg has written a lot of other really great books in the industry related to things like endless referrals, where you're just building relationship and it may lead to a sale. And certainly you don't want to do time waster activities where you're not getting to the point of a sale, but you do want to express genuine interest in the other person. And that genuine interest may or may not result in a sale, may or may not result in a referral to somebody else that might make a purchase with your organization. But the end goal is that you're just representing authentic concern for others. And he breaks it down into five laws: law of value, the law of compensation, the law of influence, the law of authenticity, and the law of receptivity. So what I found in going from the book The Go-Giver into Go Giver Sell More, they opened up the book The Go-Giver and they said, looked at key parts of each of these stories that they were working in. There's one main character that has a lot of interactions as he's discovering what these five laws are, and he's being mentored to go through these five laws. And they've gone through in Go Giver Sell More, and they break it down into a new level of how this looks in your daily business. Some of the information that came out in this book, I felt, you know, I got the principles by reading the story, but how they expanded on it in Go Giver Sell More is just amazing to then say, how do I convert that story, that nice parable example that you've laid out for me, into what my daily business looks like? What does that look like in what I'm actually doing? And how is that reflected in how I operate? So whether you are in the sales business or not, it's not really the point. You represent some company if you are employed, and you represent yourself if you are running your own business. So you're always interested in looking at how are my customer relations going, whether you're in a public part of the company or not. How is this impacting the rest of my work environment? How is this impacting, you could carry it further from just the work industry, carry it into the other parts of life too. Are you expressing just genuine concern and interest in others? And Bob's really great to bring out this point that, you know, dealing with the money topic, dealing with compensation, it's important, but it's not your first thing that you're dealing with. The first thing is, this is a person. And if you just say next and move along before they get their chance to really communicate with you, for you to build any kind of a relationship there, you potentially have just lost a sale and or lots of referrals, and that's not something you want to delve down that path. So a really good book. I would highly, highly recommend that people check it out. Go Giver Sell More by Bob Berg and John David Mann.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I'm reading like the summary that you kind of wrote here in Google Wave, and you know, when you look at this kind of stuff, this is about how to engage people, and it doesn't matter about the technology, and I don't think it ever has. You know, social media, chamber of commerce, wherever you go, meeting somebody in Starbucks. Actually, in fact, I met somebody in a Starbucks once years ago, and I don't think I've ever personally gotten any business out of them, you know, so to speak, but I've connected him to multiple times, and he's, you know, he's become a really good friend. I've actually, you know, I've gotten him with perfect clients, and I've ended up like going to dinners with him and stuff like that. And he's a director at the William James Foundation, so I get to go to his thing and his event ceremony. So that's a lot of fun. But it all comes down to, just like you say, it all comes down to building those relationships and, you know, focusing on the relationship first and not being so focused on this whole quid pro quo, you know, oh, I made the relationship. Oh, now can I get the sale? I think there's so much focus on that. And especially when we see like small businesses try to use social media, I think that's where they screw up, is because they're just so hung up on this. Well, I made a Twitter follower. Can I sell to him now? Like, oh my God. Anyway, so cool book.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I would also encourage people to check out Bob's Twitter account and his Facebook fan page. Facebook fan page is facebook.com/BergBob, and his Twitter is twitter.com/BobBerg. Watch how he uses social media. He's great with this. You know, he is just fantastic at taking the same principles that he is talking about in his book and just living that in how he interacts with social media. Just because it's an online social media channel, it doesn't mean that you get to just be buy my stuff. Even during this book launch that he's just gone through, it wasn't just buy my stuff. You know, he was creating additional value in other ways in how he's using all these channels. So really great person to watch how he's using that, but also read his book, get the content, observe also how he is translating that into his online presence. Yeah,
cool.
Very good.
So very we good. Done?
Well, that is. So can you tell me, where can listeners follow and find you?
Oh, wow. What a segue. I'm at twitter.com/Dave Saunders.
And I'm at twitter.com/Courtney Engel. That's E-N-G-L-E.
And then, of course, our main website is yourmarketflow.com.
Great. I think that's it.
We're done.
This episode. Catch you on episode 4.
Bye.